Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
The dangers of landing on a comet twice is the title of a talk to be delivered by Lawrence O'Rourke as part of the Irish National Astronomy Meeting tonight and tomorrow at Maynooth University. Lawrence was a key part of the Rosetta mission, which did just that. Lawrence, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
So give us an outline of what the Rosetta mission was. What were its aims?
Well, Rosetta was all about a satellite which launched in 2004. It travelled about 6 billion kilometres around the solar system and then arrived at a comet. And the goal of this mission was to study the comet, to study the life of a comet, to watch a comet as it got closer to the sun, going from, let's say, this big black body which is made of ice and dust, gradually getting smaller as it releases the gas and dust, and watching how this works. So how do comets, what's the life of a comet? How do they work? And not only that, of course, Rosetta landed a little probe on the surface of the comet, and finally we ended the mission last year by landing Rosetta itself. So in the end, my talk will touch upon all these different facets, but also I'll talk about how dangerous it is to fly around the comet. It's there's nothing easy about what.
Seeing you mentioned that, it would strike me as a complete ignoramus who knows nothing about these things that it's probably easier to fly to the moon than it would be to find a comet, which is smaller and I assume is it moving much faster than larger bodies would?
Well, it's flying at about 55,000 kilometres per hour, which is pretty fast.
Yeah.
And the way this works, of course, is that the comet is in elliptical orbit. So what that means is, okay, it's got a distance much, much further than the sun at its furthest point and when it's got its closest. When it gets closer to the sun, then it goes faster. So it's when it moves away, it slows down and then comes back in around the sun. It goes from 55,000 to 120,000 kilometres per hour. And what we did with Rosetta was to swing by the Earth three times, by Mars once, to speed it up, because you can only go a certain, let's say, certain speed when you leave the planet, in order to catch the comet. And we didn't just catch it, but we landed on it.
Right. And how did you go about, was there a process, kind of an X factor for comets, where you chose which was the best comet to do this with?
In fact, this comet we chose, which is a very strange name, Churyumov-Gerasimenko, it was the second comet we had chosen, because the first one we were ready to launch and then the rocket itself had an issue, so we had to cancel that launch and we chose another target. But the comet itself is chosen because it's called a Jupiter family comet. It flies between Mars and Jupiter. So it's easier to get to than other types of comets.
But easy, it's a very relative term.
It takes 10 years to get there. But it was chosen because of the fact it's easier to get there within a certain number of years within a lifetime of the satellite, because the satellite is built for a number of years, and it wasn't too big nor too small, a bit like Goldilocks in that respect. It was a perfect size, because to put a lander on the surface, well, if it's too big, then the gravity pulls the lander too fast and it'll actually hammer it on the surface. If it's too small, then it'll bounce off. And each of these were facets we had to take into account.
So, taking into account the fact that the size of it varies depending on where it is on its journey.
It's gradually getting smaller.
Yeah. How big is it?
It's about 4 kilometres, more or less. But it's gradually getting smaller. I mean, a comet is an icy body. And you might have heard of, okay, meteorites, for example. Everybody's heard of meteorites, the flying stars, but shooting stars. Well, these originate from asteroids. And asteroids are just pieces of rock, huge pieces of rock or metal flying between Mars and Jupiter. Well, comets are different. Comets are made of ice and dust. And in fact, the dust they have is carbon-based, so it's like coal. So a comet in space is like watching a piece of coal flying through space. And so in the end, the idea is to arrive there and to watch how this piece of coal, which has ice inside, is gradually releasing the ice that is made of, because it doesn't change into liquid. Ice in space changes directly into gas. The dust is trapped, so you get this huge tail left behind as the comet, this icy body, gets closer to the sun. And we're there too, with a side by each.
The size of that tail varies, presumably, dependent on the distance to and from the sun.
Yeah, so we arrived at the comet when the comet itself was still inert. It was pretty much sleeping, because it was so far away, it was so cold, the ice couldn't sublime, it couldn't produce any gas. And we did that in order to be able to have, let's say, a safer surface to put the lander on the surface, the Philae lander. We landed the Philae lander, and then we just tracked the comet as it went around the sun, watched it, let's say, getting warmer and seeing exploding rocks, ice rocks and dust flying from the comet, and we were flying through dust storms. And it's extremely dangerous, very challenging, but very exciting to work on.
Yeah, how did you... Yeah, the to get the lander on the comet when you didn't really know the topography of the comet because no one had taken a picture of it, how did you figure that out?
A very fast process, because when you want to land on Mars, normally they would make a decision where you're going to land on Mars a number of years before you arrive. I mean, even before you launch, you already have a good idea where you want to land. For this comet, we had an idea. We figured it would be elliptical, I mean, more or less smooth. We were hoping it was smooth. And what we saw was something completely different, which I showed tonight in the talk. But effectively, two bodies stuck together with cliffs, with deep holes, with crevices. And we had to try to find a flat area. So when we arrived in August 2014, we effectively had 2 months to map the surface and try to find a landing site, which we did.
Wow.
But it wasn't a flat surface in the end anyway.
Right. So then as it's moving, Is Rosetta flying beside it, or is it kind of orbiting it?
So it's flying beside it, but depending on it's a bit like when you came to work this morning, or myself, you're driving the car and you got your phone in the hand, and both of you, if you think about it,
not if you're observing the law, you're not.
No, but both of you are traveling the same speed, yourself
yes,
and the phone.
Yeah.
So in the end, you can imagine that Rosetta is the phone and the comet is the car. So you're traveling at the same speed, and if you want to go faster, you just put you increase the speed of Rosetta. So and depending on the orientation, you can fly around it in different directions, and this is what we did. We effectively changed the speed. Sometimes we were orbiting it, and orbiting is where the gravity pulls it, so you can actually stay in a stable one.
Yeah.
Other times you're doing let's say trajectories, because the gravity is the effect is so small in comparison to these huge gas explosions that you're being pushed away, and you have to try to find yourself through it.
Mm. So yeah, and presumably Rosetta and the lander were fairly robust, given that you'd have to take into account that there would be all this debris flying all over the place.
Yeah, I think it's certainly you're getting into the realm of danger, where you need to put a lot of redundancy. Let's say backup components. Everything has a backup. But the software was very, very good. It flew for 10 years. So we were able to put it through its paces and check that everything works. The lander, for example, is a little laboratory with 10 instruments, and it, of course, was designed to touch on the surface. It had two harpoons which didn't fire, so it bounced, which is good, you know. In the end, it was great. It was very exciting, because I was working with the lander, and it would have been nice if it stayed, but also it was also very nice that it moved and it travelled across the surface and gave us signs from two different locations, which was unexpected. So it's not these objects, or the satellite, the lander, were designed to fly around the comet. When you're traveling, the old mariners used to use the stars to navigate.
Mm.
Well, satellites use stars to navigate too. They have star maps, and if you're flying through a dust storm where the dust itself looks like little stars, you're trying to see stars through the dust. And tonight I'll show it in the talk, which is where you actually, the satellite itself finds the stars, and then although you got thousands and thousands of dust flying over, you're still able to track the stars. And this is a technique which was unique for Rosetta.
That's extraordinary. Now, once you'd got the lander on the comet, I suppose there's ice there. There's other things there. You know, this has been a theory that's been posited before.
Yeah.
Is that your building blocks for life?
Yeah. I mean, there's the theory of the formation of the Earth. I mean, when the Earth was formed many, many, 4.5 billion years ago or even less, it was a very hot planet. So it could not have produced the water which we have. Where did the oceans come from? Even our bodies, where did life come from? And they say that we come from stardust. And strangely enough, when you look at the stardust, the comets as they fly through, they're leaving the stardust behind. And the dust, when we analysed it, we found the building blocks of life itself, the basic parts of DNA we found in it. We also found a lot of gases which are unique to our atmosphere. I mean, of course, we found the oxygen we breathe, we found it on the comet. We found nitrogen, we found xenon, which is so particular to our atmosphere, it cannot be produced by the Earth itself. It has to come from outside. And we now know that comets must have been the provider. So we certainly found a lot of evidence that comets would be one of the providers of life on the Earth.
Where did the comets come from?
Ah, the comets, they're the leftovers of the solar system formation. So 4.5 billion years ago, the solar system formed a big, big cloud of gas and dust, which is revolving, then it compacts in the middle, there's the sun, it heats up and pushes everything out. The planets form, and what's left over from the planets in the solar system is ice and dust, which conglomerates, it gets bigger, that's the comets. And then the dust itself, which has no ice, it's closer to the sun, it just compacts, and you get these just big, you know, say stone bodies and or metal bodies, and these are the asteroids.
Mm. So to a degree, then Earth is now obviously we're in the Goldilocks zone in terms of our distance from the sun. But Earth was also lucky because enough comets crashed into it.
Well, it's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. There was but what you don't realize when you're flying away from the Earth is when you go outside Neptune, Pluto, there's a big cloud of comets out there, the Edgewood Kuiper Belt, which is a cloud of comets, thousands of comets. When you go further out, you go to the Oort cloud, which is billions of comets. So space is not empty. Okay, if you keep flying out towards a near star, you're going to come across comets everywhere.
Now, when did Rosetta touch down then on the comet?
Rosetta itself landed on the 30th of September last year. So we ended it because it was going so far from the sun, there wasn't enough, let's say, power to keep it going. Mm. So we decided to end it in the best way possible, which was get as close as possible, take the best images and sniff the gases and try to get the best science before it finished.
But even though, despite that though, I mean, there's still enough data for your team to be working on for the next couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. There's data there for tens and tens of years. We only touched, let's say, the very top part of this data, which has given us major results. But there's so much data and so many results that are still hidden in there. I think it's going to be a source of huge amount of papers to be published in the future.
That's fascinating stuff. And you can hear Lawrence talk more at length either this evening or tomorrow.
Well, just this evening, in fact.
Right. Okay. At what time?
It's at 8 o'clock.
8 o'clock
in minutes. And certainly, I invite everybody to come. I think it's going to be. I'm delighted to talk about it. And I think I've got a lot of images, a lot of video. I think I look forward to explaining this in detail.
Lawrence, thanks a million for coming into us.
Moncrief with Gas Networks Ireland. Aren't you tired of that ugly fuel storage tank, having to order and write that big check for the delivery guy? gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.